Welcome to On Publishing from the Binary Agency. This is Alex Field.
And this is Ingrid Beck. Every week, we talk to professionals from the world of publishing. Our goal is to educate, inspire, encourage, and inform.
Let's get started.
On today's episode of On Publishing, we talk with Tony Weisskopf, who is publisher, editor-in-chief, and art director at Bain Books, a science fiction publisher. Tony has won a number of awards. She won the Phoenix Award in 1994 for excellence in science fiction, the Rebel Award in 2000 for lifetime achievement in Southern science fiction fandom, and in 2015, she was nominated for a Hugo Award, as well as winning the Neffy Award as best editor in the same year.
This was a great conversation, Ingrid. Anyone who's writing anything really is going to enjoy it in terms of fiction, mm-hmm. especially. But Tony is kind of a legend in the science fiction and military science fiction worlds, and mm-hmm. has been working in this industry for long enough to have worked with some of the greats. So this was a fun conversation as she shared how she fell in love with science fiction in particular, how she fell in love with reading and writing in general. And you know, her perspective is a very unique one too, because she's not just the publisher or right. just an editor. She's both. And she really does oversee other parts of the process as well, getting deeply involved in design and cover design and illustration and things like that.
Yeah, we also talked about how they cultivate an audience at Bain, which was really fascinating to learn about how intentional they are about that. And we also learned the qualities they look for in new proposals or manuscripts and how the storyteller's voice is so critical.
She'll talk about this. You guys will hear this in just a moment, but she mentions their process and how actually the editors who are reviewing their so-called slush pile submissions actually do respond as often as they can with detailed feedback. That doesn't mean you're going to get that every time, but I think Bain is unique in that they really do care, as you said, about the author's voice. And I was fascinated by that because not every publisher can offer that kind of detailed feedback.
Absolutely. That's very rare.
Well, I hope you enjoy this interview with Tony Weisskopf. Before we get to that, if you are in the middle of writing something and you're looking for more resources or more information, please check out our website, www.thebinaryagency.com. We do have a bunch of articles up there, some on the business of publishing, some on the editorial side of publishing. A lot of those articles are there for free right now. And then there are some ebooks you can check out as well that are resources for various parts of the process. And by the way, also, if you have questions for us that you'd like us to talk about on this podcast, send us an email. info@thebinaryagency.com is our email address. Put the word podcast in your subject line and we'll get to it as quickly as we can. And maybe we'll address some of your questions here on the air. If you have subjects, people you'd like us to interview, include them as well. Without further ado, though, let's go ahead and get to our interview with Tony Weisskopf. Tony, thank you for joining us today on Publishing. We're just going to dive right in. Would you mind just telling us about your role at Bain Books today and kind of what you do every day, what a normal day looks like in your publishing life? Because I know you're a publisher, but you're also an editor as well. So you have a lot on your plate.
I do. I wear many hats at Bain, and I wear many hats because I enjoy wearing many hats. There is really no normal day, and that's not just because we do science fiction and fantasy, but because we're small enough that each day is a different challenge. So I am the publisher. I'm also the editor-in-chief, which means that I do acquisitions and work with authors directly, not just through my editors, although my editors also do that. The odd thing that we do at Bain that most publishers and editors in chief don't do is that I'm also the art director, which means,
wow.
That's it's a tremendously fun part of the job.
Yeah.
Jim did that, and he really enjoyed that. He enjoyed working directly with the artists. So when I inherited the position, I thought that I would see if I could also work as an art director as well. And the conventional wisdom is that you can't really wear both of those hats. But Jim did, so I thought, what the heck? And I've quite enjoyed it. Now, the reason I can get away with this is because we have a fantastic cadre of artists who've been working with Bain for a very long time. David Mattingly, Steve Heckman, Tom Kidd, all of those guys have been with us since the beginning of Bain, and some of them when Jim was at Tor and at Ace. This is how far back we go. We do bring in new artists. So the feel of the books doesn't change, although the artists themselves might change over time. And the other reason I can do this is because we have two fantastic cover designers who have been working with Bain for a very, very long time. Carol Russo being one of them, and the other Jenny Ferries. And they too have a deep understanding of what it is that we want the Bain brand to look like.
No, that's fun. I mean, I do know of a few other publishers who speak into that part of the process, but maybe aren't the art directors, but that's kind of cool. I mean, so you have acquisition and content focus, you have art direction focus, and then you're overseeing the whole process as publisher. Do you mind if I ask, how many books roughly are you doing a year with all those hats?
We do 6 or 7 books a month. Of those, 3 or 4 will be reprints of some kind. They'll be either reprints from our trade paperbacks or hardcovers, or they will be books from other publishers that have gone out of print and then we're reintroducing. So call it 3 or 4 original titles every month, plus more that we're value adding at some point. So it's a lot, and we've kept that up for most of our history. We ramped up in the first few years, but this is the level that we've settled at, and seems to be a good one for us.
That's great.
I think I know a little bit of this story, but I want to ask you, for those who may not know you or much about Bain, how did you start out in publishing, Tony, in the first place? Where did, and I guess even before that, you know, where did your passion and your love for reading and for books come from? And I know those are two different stories, perhaps, but maybe a little bit of that. Yeah,
it all does flow together in a beautifully coherent narrative. So, my parents were both great readers and both great readers of genre fiction. My mom didn't read science fiction very much at all, but my dad, who is an astrophysicist, read a lot in science fiction as well as mysteries and westerns and all kinds of things. And so this material was just, you know, lying around the house there for me to absorb. And my mom actively encouraged reading, and then the whole family did. So we had, you know, when my dad would go on a trip, he would bring back battered copies of Analog and fantasy and science fiction. And he had a collection of well-read dog-eared paperbacks that I eventually dove into. So I didn't really think of myself as a science fiction reader as I was growing up, but by the time I was, oh, I guess 10 or 12, I really started to investigate science fiction and just see what why my dad was so into this stuff. And I just fell in love with it. Little Fuzzy was the first adult science fiction story that I read by H.B. Piper with a fantastic whaling cover on it. And that just got me hooked. I dove into Jack Vance and read all of his Demon Prince's books that were published by Daw, those, you know, gaudy yellow spines back in the 70s. You could find them easily on the racks. So I was a science fiction reader first. Then my dad got a job with NASA, We moved to Huntsville, Alabama, and I discovered science fiction fandom when I was a teenager in Huntsville, and just fell in love with Southern fans and the Southern conventions and the fanzines. There was a Jack Vance fanzine out of Tuscaloosa at the time that was fascinating. And very, very supportive group that science fiction fandom was back in the day. Mm-hmm. One of the things that my high school did to raise money was the seniors sold magazine subscriptions. Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine was just starting, I was an early subscriber to that. I had a couple letters to the editor that George Sithers published when I was 15.
That's thrilling.
It was just, it was a great time to be a teenager, to be in science fiction. And so when I went to college, all of that followed me too. And I was a member of the science fiction club at Oberlin, and we learned to manipulate the student funding system. So we got in speakers, and we had, we had our fanzine, paid for by student funds.
Awesome.
Nice. we got in, this was really before DVDs. So we had Flash Gordon serials, the old films. We brought those in for, weekly serials, and we had a lot of fun. So I escaped college with a lot of experience in science fiction, and the firm determination that I was not going to be an academic like everybody else in my family.
What was your major at Oberlin, by the way?
Anthropology with a minor in history.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I knew that I wasn't right for the hard sciences like my dad and my great uncle were, but I was interested in the sciences, and I took physics classes while I was there, the poet's physics classes that didn't require the hard math. And I'm still interested in science in general, but I knew very early on that it was not going to be a career path for me. And anthropology is just fascinating. And it's a fantastic major for a science fiction editor because it exposes you to lots of different cultures and lots of different ways that humans approach common problems, which is a lot of what science fiction is about, right? We go back to Little Fuzzy. Little Fuzzy is talking about what does it mean to be a human, right? So I sent out my resumes and ended up graduating on a Memorial Day and going to work the following Tuesday in New York. So,
Wow. Straight into publishing. Was that with Bain or was that with someone else?
No, it was with Bain. Yeah. I've been there my entire career. I did talk to other people. I talked to the Science Fiction Book Club. I had a job lined up with Locus Magazine. I landed at Bain and it was a great place for me.
So Tony, you and your team probably review tons of manuscripts and book proposals regularly. It's a part of the process, I think. So what stands out for you when you first see a proposal? How do you know you want to bring a proposal or a project on board or work with a particular author?
Wow, that's a tough one. We do see a lot of material, which is very gratifying. A lot of that people want to work with us. These days, as Delta says, you have a choice, and we recognize, we're happy you want to fly with us. But we do see a lot of material, and we encourage that. We want to work with new writers, so we have several mechanisms in place for new writers to reach us. We have an open slush pile. We have short story contests that are judged blindly. Anybody can enter them. But I do want to emphasize that we are open to these submissions.
That's awesome.
We're always looking for that particular voice. I think Bain is known for doing well with certain subgenres, military science fiction, space opera, alternate history, urban fantasy. These are things that we've been doing for a long time, and we've had New York Times bestsellers in all of those genres, and we're known for that. But I don't like to restrict us to subgenres. It's really how a storyteller approaches a story, that's where my interest is piqued. Do you want to mm-hmm. spend time with these characters to see where this author takes them? Mm-hmm. And it can be almost any genre. But that oh, come with me, follow me into the woods. We're going to have a great time. mm-hmm. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, that voice. I mean, really, it takes a special writer to have a particular voice that has command of the story and draws the reader through it. And it's a tricky thing to master for writers. And you see it when you see it, you know it as an editor, as a publisher. I would imagine mm-hmm. it probably jumps off the page with all the submissions you're looking at.
It does, and you know, as an agent as well, that's you're looking for that for that special spark. Mm-hmm. These days, it is possible because we have very sophisticated writers at this point. There are so many resources for writers, and there are so many people who are telling you this is how to do it, that you can have a really fantastic first couple pages and then it not go anywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
Because something has been workshopped or worked on or run past beta readers or focus groups or what have you. And so that's one of the reasons why when we're asking for submissions, we do want the manuscript to be completed. And we do want to see a synopsis that tells us, all right, well, you've got a great start. How do you resolve this? Because the resolution is the thing I think that's trickiest for new writers to get to. That sense of satisfaction that you want as a reader when you put down the book and you go, oh, wow, that was great.
Yeah, that's rare. I mean, it is something we see all the time as well, where it starts off really, really strong. And you really want it to work. And maybe you even get halfway into the thing before you're like, oh, it's just not quite ready yet. Yeah. Or it's not quite there.
Yeah.
But boy, and I wonder, as an editor yourself, Tony, like what do you bring to the editing relationships that you cultivate with the authors you're serving and you're working with? Like what types of things do you look for as an editor? What types of things do you change? I'm just curious what that side of your work looks like.
Well, I do edit on a day-to-day basis. I do work on manuscripts with authors. I try to work with our newer authors rather than our more established authors, because I think that if I'm doing my job right, then after a couple of novels, you understand what it is that I'm going to ask for you to change in your work, or where I think your strengths are and would like to see more of. So really, it's where the author needs input. And for some authors, the input is you don't touch a damn word. For me, that's the ideal. You don't need that. That you go, wow, this is fantastic. Here's $50,000 in a check, just like Snoopy wants, right? Right. But most of the time, that's not the case. Most of the time, there'll be a suggestion here or there. For one author, he was shying away from where his really fun beginning was going. And I said to him, look, have the courage of your convictions. We will publish this if you follow this through. But this is where it seems to me this is going. Is this what you intended? And indeed, it was what he intended. But he had been shying away from it as being too controversial. And the final book was something that we were both happy that he had said what he wanted to say. And that brought the book together and made it a coherent whole, where before it was kind of wishy-washy. So, you know, sometimes it's on that level. Sometimes it's you're not ending scenes right. You need a punchier ending for your scenes. Otherwise, the plotting and characters are great. You know? So it just really depends on what's needed for each individual project.
Yeah, every author's different.
Yeah. And every project is different, too. I mean, somebody who, you know, does great for one thing might need a little help with something else. And the other, you know, it really depends on every book.
How have you seen publishing change, particularly for your company? How have those changes impacted the category of science fiction more broadly? And how have they impacted your team?
We do tend to long-term relationships at Bain, not just the artists and the cover designers, but also the editors and the authors as well. So we have a more stable ship than a lot of places, I think.
That's
because
great.
Because we do have that continuity of mm-hmm. people. There have been lots of changes in the structure of publishing, in the business of publishing. we've seen, you know, the rise of the paperback has been in my lifetime. The rise of the mass market mall bookstore I got to see. Mm-hmm. And sadly, I've seen the demise of these things as well.
Yeah, that's right.
But those are just delivery formats. They're just ways of delivering a story to the reader. So in place of those things, we now have ebooks. And this is our mass communication method. Before I got in the business, pulp magazines, they were the way that you delivered a mass product to a mass audience. I think the business is constantly changing, and the ways that we get stories to readers are constantly changing. But what the publisher's job is, get the stories to the readers, that doesn't change. How you accomplish that, but your purpose hasn't changed. And I think there's just a more clear awareness of this now, that what the publisher's job actually is. It's not selling books, it's getting stories out. And, you know, of course, everybody makes money. This is you know, one of the points of this.
And the business keeps going. Yeah.
Well, the business keeps going, and the writers are able to write. That the successful authors are reaching a big enough audience so that they can do what it is that they do. That's important.
That's very important. And I think it's funny. I think some writers and authors, they're not thinking about maybe the responsibilities or the challenges that the publisher is facing. And I know, especially with changes like the ones you described recently, and even, you know, mall bookstores and the rise of paperbacks years ago, those challenges crop up in those times when those changes happen. So I guess I would ask, when challenges like that arise for you, Tony, or for Bain, what sort of opportunities come out of that? Or what sorts of things are you seeing that authors and publishers can take as opportunities in those times?
Ooh, I don't know. I really don't know. Bain is independent. We're distributed by Simon & Schuster, one of the big four or five or whatever you call the large publishers these days. So we have our distribution to, you know, wherever you can get books, we can go. But we're not owned by Simon & Schuster, so our decision-making process can be very quick. Yeah. So when ebooks started to be a thing, Jim Bain was able very quickly in the late 90s to put together a program and do the market research, listen to his audience and figure out, all right, this is what people will pay. And we, you know, so we had that figured out way long before the rest of the field did, which means now, 20 years later, that we have a mature audience and a mature delivery system for this, so that we have a core that's very, very steady. And that, again, that allows us to ride these waves that seem so catastrophic to other houses a little more easily, I think.
That's important. I mean, especially being an independent publisher, which brings its own challenges and benefits. That is important that you have that. And you've also seemed to cultivate a diehard audience, like a readership that comes to you for books, you know, every day, every week. They're coming to look at what's new. And that's not always the case these days, from what I've seen in publishing houses. That you're not cultivating that audience as much. And I think you guys have done a really good job of that.
Well, that's not by accident. We love our readers, and our primary job is to provide them with good reading material. And we do listen to them. We do listen to what it is that they want. And part of the reason that we can do that is because we are them. We are publishing books that we want to read, the kind of science fiction that we love and that we want to see still be available. So, yes, we very definitely set out to create a brand, which is to say a consistent product that people could go to and be satisfied just solely on the basis of the publisher's logo. And that's, and one of the ways that we do that is that we're not, you know, we're not Walmart, right? We're not everything to everybody. We do publish a fairly wide range of things, as I've said before, but the kind of storytelling that you're going to get is the kind where you finish the book and go, oh yeah, wow, that was fantastic. whether it be Mercedes Lackey who was doing it, or Larry Correa, or David Drake, or Tim Powers, you're going to get that satisfaction. And you know, if you put these four authors together and pick four random books by these people, you wouldn't necessarily see, well, what are the elements that you can pick out? There's no elements you can pick out. There's not a thing that you can go to analyze and say, you know, say to your writing class, well, if you do these things, then you're going to be a great storyteller. You're not. But the reading experience is what we're looking for. And those authors will get you there. So
with that in mind, I love diving into these discussions about writing and what an author needs to think about. But with that in mind, have you ever come alongside younger authors that you see that spark in, but it's not there? It's not the finished product yet, or the manuscript isn't where it needs to be. And do you ever, and I know that you're already so, so busy, but do you ever kind of push them along or coach them in that process?
Oh yeah, all the time. Yeah. 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 And not necessarily people that we end up publishing either. If somebody is very promising, we'll give them feedback. Sometimes they're right for Bain and sometimes they're not. Some of these writers have gone on to do good things at other places, and that's great. I say we, because it's not just me. It's also my other editors, Tony Daniel and Jim Minns. But primarily our Slushmaster General, our consulting editor, Gray Reinhardt. He is a fantastic nurturing editor, and he's the one who oversees our unsolicited manuscripts, and he's very detailed and gives fantastic feedback. We do that in a lot of different ways. So
yeah, that's unusual. I don't know very many publishers who are able to offer that service to aspiring writers. So that's great.
Well, it's not a service. You can't buy it.
that's a benefit.
But yeah. One of my newer editors, Christopher Rocchio, would take exception to this, the notion of karma. But certainly it's a notion of pay it forward, right? Bread upon the waters. If we see somebody that we can encourage, we are going to encourage them. It's what we do.
Well, I think that makes a difference, especially in the industry, what that can be kind of discouraging, I think, especially for writers who are starting out.
Well, it's a very competitive market out there. There are literally millions of words published every day in our genres, right. Which makes it very hard for readers to find good stuff. And it makes it very hard for writers to be able to distinguish themselves. So anything that we can do to help, we do try to do that.
Tony, I wonder what piece of advice you would have for those like you, or maybe like us, who really want to work in the industry or have worked. What sort of advice would you give for if they want to break into a particular publisher, a particular category? There might be somebody listening who's in college still and studying a particular thing, or maybe it's English, maybe it's history or anthropology like you. What would you say to someone who really, really wants to work in publishing?
Marry well. No, that's...
I love it.
I'm only halfway kidding there, but back in my day, what you had to do was be willing to work for crappy wages and still be able to live in New York, that there was a winnowing process, right? If you could, there were a lot of entry-level jobs at the time, but you were paid minimum wage or below minimum wage, had to embarrass Jim Bain into paying minimum wage. But there were no benefits, there were none of that. So you had to be able to survive a couple of years doing really crappy jobs before you got to do really fun stuff. And at Bain, that was different. You still had the crappy wages, but you got to do fun stuff right away, because Jim was really, really good at nurturing editors as well as authors. We were just talking about that at his memorial. How many editors who came to his memorial because Jim gave them their start. There was Terry Windling and Susan Allison and a whole bunch of people at Tor and just a lot. Wow. And Betsy Mitchell, who are still working in the field or retired now, because Jim Bain, you know, let them do real work, So at any rate, that was back in my day. And you just, at that point, you just had to look in the New York Times classifieds for jobs, right? Wow. right. That doesn't work anymore. It is very, very easy to get started in the business. Just as for authors, you can post your books and have them available for sale the instant you type the end or even before. editors can do the same thing. They can set out their shingle. They can go on Facebook. They can go online and create a web page and say, "I'm an editor." And I know people who have started out that way, because self-publishing is such a huge thing, and so many people are out there. Many, many more authors are hiring editors to get a second opinion on their work. It's because they're not going the traditional publishing route. So there's a market there. It has not yet been organized. There is absolutely no way to tell the quality of one editor from another. if you are consuming editorial services, at some point, there'll be certifications and stuff like that. But the fact is that somebody who is a great editor for one author isn't necessarily a great editor for another author, isn't necessarily a great editor for a different project. Somebody who does really good with hard science fiction may not do as well with your alternate history. it's a very tricky kind of thing. So if you're trying to break into the field, being plugged into the science fiction community will not hurt you. Making yourself known to the editors who are in New York, being aware of the openings in the genre companies, that certainly can't hurt. And I certainly was when I was in college, and everybody had my resume. It just happened that Maine was the first opening. But there are many, many other ways to do it other than going to New York and living like a rat. So as with publishing, there's the non-traditional path. There's no one standard way of doing things anymore. So it's tricky. It's tricky.
Right. This is one of the questions we ask people we interview about. We'd love to hear, what are your greatest joys in your work? What part of your job really gets you up in the morning?
Well, the chance of reading a really great story is why I'm here. I got to read a new Lee Aden novel by Sharon Lee and Steve Miller a couple of days ago, and that was great.
I love it.
Yeah, you get to go dive into a deeply realized universe with characters that you know and have great adventures, and there are new characters and new things that are happening, and that's fantastic. I'm getting paid to read science fiction in my pajamas. Doesn't get better than that.
It's true. I love what we do.
But in terms of gratifying things, being able to call an author and say, "Hey, I read your first novel. I really loved it. I'd like to make you an offer." That's fantastic. I love being able to do that. Or to work with a new artist to say, "Hi, I saw your portfolio that you sent in, and I really like your work, and we'd like to try you out for this book." Those are great things. Getting to say yes to somebody's deeply held dream is fantastic. Absolutely love that part. Being able to call somebody and say, "You know what? we made the Times list. That's really great. I love being able to do that.
Yeah.
That is a good moment.
Yeah. It is a good moment. I like signing the big ass royalty checks. Those are fun too.
Yeah.
That means it's working.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's great. Those are the absolutely fantastic, gratifying parts of my job. I get to work with great people all the time. That's another thing, is that I work with really intelligent, really interesting, fun people, both the people at Bain, but also our authors. And again, our artists are, fun to talk to. They're great guys. And a few gals, but mostly guys, I work with fantastic people all the time. And, I've done retail in my day and I like this.
Yeah, it's pretty great to get to read all day and find those great stories. Even though all the reading may not be great, you keep reading until you find that one that you really believe in. And I imagine too, Tony, because this is a hard business. You don't get to make those calls every day about the New York Times list, right? So I imagine that these moments and finding these great stories kind of helps keep hope alive when it's hard, because this is a hard industry sometimes.
It is. And that's, that's the danger for if you've been around it for a while, is getting jaded, and having your judgment tarnished by all of the not so great things that you have to read, because that's your job, right? if you're going to protect the readers from mediocrity, then you have to read a lot of mediocrity before you get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
I have to recharge my batteries. I will go back and read Bujold and read Heinlein and read Kipling and read Twain and just read fantastic things just to remind myself how to get back there to that feeling of this is a great story. Man, that was fantastic. I want more of that. I want to dive into everything this author has ever done. So you have to be able to get to that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I wonder if I could ask you about your role as a publisher for a second, because I am fascinated by this. There are a lot of unique things in that role that are challenging and good and things to learn. But as a leader, leading a team, what have you learned about leading in the publishing industry specifically, just for those who might be in a similar role somewhere else or aspiring to that? What sorts of things are important to know about being a publisher?
Well, you are working with really intelligent, fantastic, creative people. So it's not so much leading as inspiring. The analogy to herding cats is, perhaps overused, but, you can't herd cats. You can only inspire them to do what it is that you want to do. So I think being able to articulate and share the vision is part of one of the things that a publisher is supposed to do. I worked with Jim Bain. I've seen Tom Doherty, who is also very generous with his time. And what they both did was, as I say, guide and inspire, but let your creative people be creative, let them do what it is that they do without trying to force them into little boxes. Because that's where creativity goes to die if you have to do the same thing over and over and over again. That's how I work with my artists, and that's how, for the most part, I work with my authors as well. Is we discuss the various possibilities and decide together what it is that the next thing should be. But you can't force people to do things. That's not leadership.
I once heard someone ask, about a particular person's boss, do you feel managed or do you feel led? And that feels like what you just described. Yeah, that's, leadership is different from management in some way,
yeah,
at least in that analogy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wonder if we could wrap up with you sharing with our listeners about some of the books that have really changed everything for you, whether it was a science fiction story like Little Fuzzy or a particular novel that just, you went, oh, hang on, we're gonna publish more of this, or I don't know, personally, if it changed you in some way or for your career, what was a book or several books that sort of changed everything for you?
Huh. I guess it's because I started with this at such a young age that there wasn't much to change. But there absolutely were authors that were just touchstones for me. Robert Heinlein, for one. Even his crap is useful to look at. he's a fascinating writer and so good for drawing the reader in. It makes it very hard to study because you fall in every time you start to like, I'm going to really analyze this. No, you're not. You are just going to read. The things of his that are going to live forever are going to be his short stories and his juveniles and the very best of his adult novels. And they are going to live forever. Those are going to be part of the canon, 50, 100 years from now. Those were important to me. Mentioned Kipling and Twain before. I was exposed to those at such a young age. My grandparents were immigrants. And my grandmother on my mother's side taught herself how to read English, reading Kipling and Twain.
Wow.
Good place to start.
And Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazines, right?
Oh, awesome.
Right.
Yes.
So whenever I visited her, this was what was on the shelf, in the guest bedroom. This was what was there. So I don't think you can understand American fiction without reading the best of those authors as well. Jane Austen to a certain extent, but even more than that, Georgette Heyer.
I love Georgette Heyer.
As you should. She is awesome, and she wrote genre fiction, but saying she wrote genre fiction is like saying Beethoven wrote symphonies.
Right.
Well, yes, but he wrote the very best. Mozart wrote incidental music. Well, yeah, but the quintessence of those genres, and you would be amazed at how many science fiction writers have been influenced by Heyer, men and women. So, Alex, if you haven't yet read Heyer, I have a reading list.
I can
recommend.
Good. Yes. I mean, there are different starting points for different personalities, but I suspect that Alex may be a Grand Sophie sort. So.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I have a copy of that.
I'll get that joke in a few weeks.
So she and for science fiction writer, what she did was she created a world. And actually, I got a book 2 years ago in the mail that I'm finally getting to from a science fiction fan and from Los Angeles named John Hertz, who I've known for many, many years. And he sent me Nabokov's lectures on literature. And I have never read Lolita, but I suspect I would hate it. But the lectures, which I've just started reading, look to be fascinating. And he opens up his course, which was intended for undergraduates at Wellesley, with Jane Austen in Mansfield Park. And he talks about how great literature, great authors create a world. Now, he wasn't talking about science fiction, but he's saying that every great novelist is, they're not writing historicals, they're creating a world. And Heyer does that. And of course, this is really, really useful for science fiction writers to be able to see how that's done, right?
Yeah.
So Georgette Heyer was somebody that my mom introduced me to at when I was like 9 or 10 or something like that. Somebody that I turned to over and over again and reread because she tells great stories and has fantastic characters and just because she's just so very good at what it is that she does. These are some of the great writers that have influenced me.
Wow. Well, I have a whole list of cool things to explore now, including Georgette Heyer and Nabokov's lectures on literature. Thank you, Tony, for sharing a little bit of your story and your experience and the things that you love to read with us today. I'm excited to go do some exploring of my own now and look forward to talking again soon about some future projects. So thank you again, Tony, for your time.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of On Publishing. If you loved what you heard, don't forget to subscribe and post a review.
This episode was edited by Joey Howell, and the music was provided by Not the King. And remember, until next time, one book can change everything.